Hi, my name is Kerry Mills. I'm an advanced respiratory nurse practitioner working in primary care in a GP surgery in Hereford. I'm also an associate trainer for Education for Health. Prior to working in primary care, I was the lead interstitial lung disease nurse, amongst many other roles, in the acute trust as a CNS for nearly 17 years. Today's podcast is about interstitial lung disease, and the key thing to remember that it's different to that of the diseases of asthma and COPD, essentially because it affects a different part of the lung anatomy. So interstitial basically means the bits in between. So it affects the alveoli and the surrounding blood supply around the lung tissue. So when we talk about the terminology of interstitial lung disease, we talk about the interstitium, which is beyond that terminal bronchial, so the airways in the periphery, and it affects, as I've said, the tissue in between lung tissue, in between the alveoli, and affects the lymphatic tissue. It also affects the lung parenchyma, which is we would refer to as the business end. This is where the alveoli sit. And when you get inflammation or scarring or fibrosis, here you get an alveolitis type picture. Interstitial lung disease is an umbrella term for over 200 different types of diseases of the interstitium, and it can be a very complicated process to get the diagnosis right. The classification of the disease can vary not only in its clinical course, presentation, pathophysiology, but also in the prognosis and the treatment for the patient. But broadly speaking, interstitial lung diseases can be subdivided into those with an identifiable cause and those without. And the aim, therefore, when a patient presents with symptoms of interstitial lung disease, that the assessment is paramount in either ruling in or out any obvious cause. Getting the terminology correct in ILD is really important, and the classification of the diseases can be really, really complex. And in 2002, there was an international guidance classification document, ATS-ERS, that helped to subdivide the patients according to what presenting factors there were, what historical exposure, any systematic type diseases, any obvious triggers, causes, insults, or those that had no obvious trigger or exposure, which were classified as the idiopathic type. There has been a large piece of work and evidence with reference to interstitial lung disease in the last two decades, and the management and diagnosis has changed significantly during that time. The key thing really is that any patient with a suspected disease of interstitial lung disease of any type needs to be referred to a specialist multidisciplinary team to make that diagnosis. And that team will typically include your respiratory consultant with an interstitial lung disease specialty, the radiologist, pathologist, and a CNS in that specialty. The most common type of interstitial lung disease and those without a known cause are referred to as the idiopathic interstitial pneumonias, the IIP. It's important also to try and understand what's actually happening in the lungs. And we know that all interstitial lung disease is characterised by variable degrees of inflammation and variable degrees of fibrosis. And in summary, really, the lung has limited repertoire in response to injury, and you'll find that fibrosis or inflammation is the only response. The damage can vary between the disease spectrums and the patients, and therefore classification to getting the diagnosis right is key. I will focus today on the idiopathic type of disease that we will more commonly find, called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. And this accounts for about 40% of the interstitial lung disease that we will come across. Unfortunately, we are aware that this condition is on the increase, and approximately 6,000 patients a year are diagnosed with IPF. And the stark reality is that the average survival rate is between 3 to 5 years from diagnosis. The process within the lungs in IPF is very complex and poorly understood, but we do understand that it involves more of a fibrosis picture, and you have an abnormal wound healing following repeated injury to the alveolar region. We understand that the fibroblasts in the lung tissue, which are there to assist in healing, overproduce, and this then leads to another cascade of mechanisms and a change in the normal architecture of the lung. This unfortunately leads to an irreversible fibrotic damage, and it is thought that the inflammation in the airways is less dominant in this type of ILD. This is important to understand, as the immunosuppression type medication does not have any effect on the patient, and we need to be accessing antifibrotic treatment. And in fact, there is evidence from the PANTHER study that shows that the immunosuppression type medications is detrimental. The patient typically presents with an insidious onset of cough and or exertional dyspnea. They're typically male, over 60 years, and usually have a previous history of smoking exposure. These will be the patients that describe to you in a previous 6 months they were able to ride their bicycle, they were able to walk their dog, but have found that their level of activity has decreased in quite a marked change. On examination, one of the classical signs will be bibasilar inspiratory crackles, and this is deemed to be one of the first clinical signs that often gets missed. If the patient goes for a chest x-ray at this time, or if there's an incidental chest x-ray for another reason, on occasion you can see radiological evidence of fibrosis, but in this situation it would have been more advanced. We are aware that there is a potential genetic disposition in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Don't clearly understand, but it is thought that about 20% will have a genetic link. As I've already said, we're looking at ruling in or ruling out when we are coming across these patients for the first time or considering interstitial lung disease, and therefore they would have a diagnostic blood workup to rule out a known cause. For example, they'd have a fibrotic screen, ANA and ANCA, rheumatoid factor, a serumase to look for any evidence of sarcoid, precipitins to any specific IgE, so you're looking for any allergic triggers, and CRP to look for any inflammatory markers. It's crucial to get a really good history from these patients to help assist with focusing your mind on the diagnosis. So you'd be looking at any questions with reference to acid reflux. Acid reflux is a significant problem in causing interstitial lung disease. Is there any connective tissue disease, including Raynaud's? Look at their occupational history. What exposure have they had during their career? Go way back to current. Ask about any exposure to birds, as avian precipitins can be an issue. Any current and previous drugs. Pneumatox is a really good app to look at any specific drugs that could cause lung damage. Oxygen saturation is useful, as this patient group typically desaturate on exertion. ECG to rule out any other cause for breathlessness. If this patient goes on to have spirometry, they would typically present with potentially normal spirometry or with a restricted picture. So they have the ability to have a good FEV1, forced expired volume in 1 second, but their total lung volumes are reduced because of the stiffness of the lungs and the inability to for their lungs to expand. Or they could have a mixed obstructed restricted picture because they could have some underlying COPD. Other clinical signs that you may come across with this patient group is central cyanosis, clubbing. I would therefore recommend having a very high suspicion index for a IPF for a patient over the age of 45 with a smoking history. Don't always assume it's COPD, who presents with retractable cough, exertional dyspnea, more than you'd anticipate in COPD, bibasilar inspiratory crackles, finger clubbing, restricted spirometry with some radiological evidence of on chest x-ray of fibrosis. This patient then needs referring on to the specialist team. NICE advocate that every patient with suspected IPF have a detailed history, as I've discussed, thorough clinical examination looking for those key signs, and the blood tests to help exclude the ILD with a known cause. Picking up the diagnosis early is critical, and a study in thorax in 2011 showed that patients potentially presented 5 years prior to the diagnosis. They demonstrated that 43% had breathlessness in the year prior to their diagnosis, and even 4 to 5 years prior to diagnosis, the cases were 3 times more likely to present with breathlessness than control, and twice as likely to present with cough. Fatigue and weight loss is something I haven't mentioned yet. It was less common, but it is a significant symptom for this patient group. There are significant benefits to the patient if we get an early referral to the specialist team. Firstly, it makes us more confident in the diagnosis. It initiates an MDT input with the support that comes with that, particularly from the CNS position. By getting a clear diagnosis from an MDT, this gives the patient access to trials, access to treatments, and access to appropriate supportive care, transplant referral, support groups, etc. Again, this is endorsed by the NICE guidance. Boehringer did a really good piece of work a couple of years ago about raising the profile for early diagnosis of IPF. It was a piece of work called Listen for the Sounds of IPF, and there are patient information leaflets, and it basically are posters to go into primary care to look out for Velcro crackles on the chest, patients with shortness of breath, dry cough, and finger clubbing. And the message is really realise, recognise, and refer. Once the patient goes on to have a referral into the MDT, they will very likely have a CT scan, but the CT scan can be arranged in primary care, or actually this is what the patient first, this is how we first pick up the ILD. Typically in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, there is a classical presentation. It is very distinctive, and you've probably heard of honeycombing in the lungs, and it looks like a honeycomb, and it typically sits at the periphery of the lung fields, again bilaterally, and this gives the MDT confidence in the diagnosis. However, the pattern isn't always classical of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and then what will happen with the MDT is the patient may be considered for a bronchoscopy and biopsy, and probably a bronchial lavage to try and get cell type and tissue type to see what type of process is going on. So they would be looking for an inflammatory process or a fibrotic process to assist with the diagnosis. In some cases where the diagnosis is still not clear, the patient may need to go for a surgical biopsy to establish again what the diagnosis is, and therefore put the patient into the right category to ensure that they get the right treatment. As you can see, the diagnostic process for interstitial lung disease is very protracted and can be very difficult. Firstly, the patient presents with not very pleasant symptoms. They often see people that aren't very confident in interstitial lung disease. They then get referred to the specialist teams. They have to wait for different procedures to establish a diagnosis. And then once the diagnosis is given, it is not uncommon for this patient group to say at least it's not cancer. Unfortunately, what patients don't appreciate and what the public don't appreciate, and nor do many healthcare professionals, is that this is a terminal disease. And as I've already said, the prognostic outcome is pretty poor. And the average survival is between 3 and 5 years from diagnosis. So if the diagnosis has been made late, then this leaves even less time for the patient. We know that there are treatment options now available for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and there are two medications that NICE advocate, and these are antifibrotic medications called pirfenidone and nintedanib. Both medications have shown to slow down the pace of the disease progression and therefore reduce the rate of the patient's functional decline. However, the patient needs to reach specific criteria before they can be considered, and this is quite controversial. So we talked about the patient's vital capacity, their total lung capacity, and that needs to be between 50% and 80% of predicted value before they would be considered for initiation of treatment. And the treatment is started by the tertiary services. So the patients will be referred by primary care to secondary care specialist services, and then from secondary care, who work very closely with the tertiary services at MDT level, refer them for their antifibrotic therapy. But it'll be a shared care protocol between the tertiary service and secondary care, and this will depend very much where you work. It is essential that the patient has exactly the right amount of monitoring and support for this drug therapy. There are common side effects that patients can really struggle with, but actually can be managed with clinicians that understand the drug and the disease. And the patient requires frequent lung function. And the thing to remember is that the guidance will state that if the patient shows any signs of the disease progression more than 10% in 12 months, the treatment will be stopped. And this is quite a difficult thing for the patient to hear. The evidence suggests that pulmonary rehab is key in any type of respiratory disease, but also interstitial lung disease. But it does need to be focused on ILD, as it is very different to that of COPD. So the educational component needs to be different, and the exercise regime altered, mainly because of the exertional desaturation, and these patients often need assessment through the home oxygen services with a team that are happy and confident in dealing with interstitial lung disease, because this patient group often need a higher flow of oxygen therapy, don't typically have any CO2 retention. Best supportive care, again, it's essential from the diagnostic point. It has to be patient focused and tailored to the individual's disease severity, the rate of progression, and the person's preference. Patients need appropriate and accurate information and support, and I believe that we as healthcare professionals are responsible for guiding patients to the appropriate information. Interstitial lung disease, in my experience, is generally misunderstood. There is limited knowledge in both the clinical and the public arena, really. There are some really fabulous patient self-help groups that have been really proactive in supporting idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and I would recommend that you look at these sites: Action PF Pulmonary Fibrosis Group and British Lung Foundation, all fabulous resources for us as clinicians for learning, but also to direct our patients to for support, and to believe that they've got a voice. One of the hardest things with this patient group is managing their very difficult symptoms. Their shortness of breath, their cough, fatigue and weight loss can be extremely debilitating for this patient group, and they need the correct support to manage the symptoms. Who delivers this support will depend very much on local knowledge and expertise, but typically the patient will work very closely with the interstitial lung disease nurse, specialist, the physio, and also the palliative care team. And in my experience, involvement of the palliative care team earlier rather than waiting for end of life care is significantly beneficial to the patient, because they can attend the day hospice support for the family, look at the fatigue and breathlessness support mechanisms that the hospice can also offer. But again, the services will vary according to where you're working. And I think the last point I want to make really is that interstitial lung disease does require specialist input. However, these patients can present to any healthcare setting at any time with symptoms of interstitial lung disease. We need to raise the profile of these symptoms. We need to ensure patients get early diagnosis and access to the treatment, and that we have a better understanding of the disease for the patients. Therefore, it is everyone's responsibility to get this diagnosis right and quickly for the benefit of our patients. I would advocate that to support this podcast, you access the NICE guidance on interstitial lung disease management with the pirfenidone and nintedanib, the ATS and ERS documents for clinical practice guideline 2018, and definitely access the patient groups. Thank you very much for your time. I hope this has been useful.